Today on the program, the logistics of drug prices, the economics of Jägermeister, seriously, and a trip to Ciudad Juarez for our series, My Economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the fourth day of February. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We turn first to the capital of the United States, the House of Representatives specifically. A House Oversight and Government Reform Committee hearing this morning into the high and rising price of prescription drugs. Exhibit A was Martin Shkreli, the now former CEO of Turing Pharmaceuticals, who, you might remember, became public enemy number one last year when he bought the rights to a drug called Daraprim, and promptly jacked the price up from $13.50 a pill to 750 American simoleons, each and every one of them. Shkreli's under indictment for a separate securities fraud case, so his comments today started and ended with this.
On the advice of counsel, I invoke my Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination and respectfully decline to answer your question.
But the hearing did continue after Shkreli was excused because drug prices are high. Part of that is because there are no price controls on pharmaceuticals in this country. Another part is that there has been a huge backlog of generic drug applications at the FDA, theoretically cheaper generic drugs, right? That backlog has started to thin out, though, and Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the health desk at WHYY that could bring some price relief.
Let's go back to 2012. The generic program at the FDA was something out of a Kafka novel. 4,739 generic drug applications had piled up. Products, remember, with the power to cut how much we pay for prescription drugs. It was unacceptable. And generic manufacturers and the FDA hammered out a deal.
We redid everything about the program and built it to a modern review process. And we are just really going to crank the next 2 years, I've no doubt.
That's Dr. Janet Woodcock from the FDA. The 2012 deal was that generic manufacturers would pay fees totaling $1 billion over 3 years. Since then, the FDA has hired 1,000 people and has seen approvals shoot from about 35 a month in early 2014 to 99 last December.
The real solution is the solution that always works, which is introduce more competition in the market.
Adam Fine with Pembroke Consulting says speeding up approvals is working. All week, drug wholesalers have reported generic profit slowdowns in their earnings calls, which suggests there's less money to be made in the sector. That said, there's still certain rare disease drugs with no competition, which are ripe for exploitation, says Harvard economist Meredith Rosenthal.
We should provide strong incentives to generic manufacturers who are willing to enter in these relatively small markets.
Rosenthal says if we really want to end crazy price gouging, we've got to identify generic drugs that have monopolies or near monopolies. And if the federal government has to pay companies to get into those markets, then pay them. The benefit, she argues, is worth it. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Should you happen to tune in to tonight's Democratic presidential debate between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, you will likely hear the word progressive quite a bit. The two candidates are having a heated back and forth over whose policies are the more progressive. So Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more now on the economics of American politics circa 2016.
The progressive movement started in the late 1800s. It was an effort to get away from political bosses and make government more professional. Price Fishback can explain it better than I can. He's a professor of economics at the University of Arizona.
To give more voting power to people, to make government more professional, and to expand the use of government for helping people.
That's Fishback's definition, but the word progressive has never been easy to define.
It's a really messy term.
That messiness can come in handy if you're running for president. You can define the term pretty much any way you want, and then offer up some economic policies you call progressive. Emily Tisch Sussman is with the left-leaning Center for American Progress Action Fund. She says both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton call themselves progressives on health care. Tisch Sussman says Clinton is tackling drug prices.
And a piece of that is allowing the government to negotiate with drug companies on Medicare and Medicaid.
Tisch Sussman says Sanders is opting for universal health care funded by the government.
He's saying, let's get to a place where we can have all single payer.
Clinton and Sanders also advocate a higher minimum wage and government help with college tuition. Sanders wants it to be free. But is any of this doable? Not if you ask David Caputo.
So I think both of them are overstating their case in terms of what they might be able to get done.
Caputo is a professor of political science at Pace University. He will be watching the debate tonight, but has no prediction on how many times the word progressive will pop up. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
17. I think it's going to pop up 17 times. All right, a little bouncy on Wall Street today. Things ended pretty close to where they started, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're bringing you stories from El Paso, Texas this week for our election year series, My Economy. El Paso is a place where a lot of people split their lives between the U.S. and Mexico.
I work here and Juarez is more better.
How come?
Because, like, the dollar in Juarez is more.
You get paid in dollars and you spend money in pesos.
Yeah.
And when you run a small business in the borderland like this guy does, you have to worry not just about our economy, but the Mexican economy as well.
I'm living the American dream, but it's a break-even American dream. We have one strong variable going on against all of us, and that's the devaluation of the peso or the appreciation of the dollar, whichever way you want to look at it.
In El Paso, in a very real sense, the local economy is the global economy. So today, what it's like to live in that economy.
The life and the kind of job that I want.
Prosperity.
Providing for your children.
My head above water.
My economy.
My economy.
My economy.
Thing is, when you're doing a story about the average person's everyday economy, sometimes the only way to do it...
Hello, sir. How are you?
How are you?
Hi.
Hey.
Hi, how are you?
I'm Kai. Nice to see you. How are you?
I'm Kai. Nice to see you. How are you?
Good to see you.
Is to just go talk to random people on the street. Millions of people cross the Paso del Norte Bridge between El Paso and Juarez every year, tens of thousands in a day. And one of those people while we were there was Eusebio Martinez.
Tell me what you do. Tell me about yourself.
I live right here in El Paso. I work at Sam's Club.
How long have you been doing that?
5 years.
Eusebio is an American citizen. He's 44 years old, born and raised in El Paso. He makes $11 an hour at Sam's Club, and he is one of thousands of people in this city who lives life between two countries.
Well, how come you're coming across?
I went to visit my wife. She lives at Juarez.
Your wife lives in Juarez, yes, you live here?
Yeah, she was deported, so we're waiting for the lawyer to get papers right now and everything to bring her back.
We'd stopped him coming back into El Paso after visiting his wife, Maria, in Juarez. She's not an American citizen, but she had lived here since she was 4 years old until she was deported back in August after getting caught by immigration after a traffic stop. So anyway, Eusebio goes to visit her, and then he walks back home to El Paso in time for a shift at Sam's Club with waits at the border that can be as long as 4 hours. And he does it every single day. I wanted to know what that part of this kind of economic life is like. So the next afternoon, I walked over to Juarez myself. Getting into Juarez is kind of a breeze. You pay, I guess you'd call it a transit fee.
Hi, there are four of us. How much do we have to pay?
$2, there you go.
And then once you're off the bridge, you're on Calle Juarez.
PC 51 Puente Internacional Paso del Norte is what it says as you cross the border. Just like that, you're in Mexico.
It's a loud, wide, dusty main street. It's lined with cheap pharmacies, small shops and bars and restaurants, music playing all the while. The city's reputation precedes it, of course, but the murder rate in Juarez is nowhere near what it was just 3 or 4 years ago. It's not perfect, but it's safe enough to walk around for a bit.
How are you? Thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Eusebio picked us up on a corner in his van. He took us to his wife Maria's house in Juarez, about a mile or so from the border. It used to be her grandmother's place. It's small. It's on a corner with stucco peeling off its walls.
Sorry for the mess.
Oh, please. Don't worry about it.
Nobody had been living there for quite a while until Maria moved in last summer.
Is this your grandson, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
It's your little kid.
The space is tight. It's a small living room. And a little dining area, just a couch set and a small table. Some parakeets you can hear right there in the background. But the house, it's basically fallen apart.
We're going to have to put everything
fix it up.
There's some holes in the ceiling.
Yeah, we've been trying to fix it a lot.
Please, let's just sit down and we'll just talk for a second. How did you guys meet?
In elementary.
In elementary school?
In elementary.
So you guys have been together for
31 years
together.
Wow.
We met at fourth grade, and we got together when we were at seventh grade.
That's a long time.
We already have seven grandkids.
Well, you know, no wasting time. No wasting time.
Maria's parents took her to El Paso when she was just 4 years old. She and Eusebio built their lives there. They've got three grown children and seven grandchildren, all American citizens, all of whom live in El Paso.
So tell me about your life. How do you make this work?
We have to make the best of it, too.
Because I'm not used to live here. I never lived here.
She's not used to yet.
I was born here, but I never lived here. I've been raised over there in El Paso.
Without documents the whole time.
I got them, but...
Approved. For the residency, but we didn't finish the process, so she got deported.
Okay, so now you're waiting for how long do you think it's going to be until everything gets...
It's right now with the laws and everything, it's real, real, real slow. It's taking a long time.
And I'm going to have to wait about 5 to 10 years to fix up my papers again.
5 to 10 years, she said. You can't get American citizenship just by marrying a citizen. It takes time and a whole lot of paperwork.
The good thing is that the violence is not like it used to be before. Right now, everything's getting like kind of back to normal over here on this side. Because if it would have been like 2-3 years ago, there was no way. They kill a lot of people around here, neighbors, sons of the neighbors.
Right around this house?
Yeah. Right here in the alley, there's like a house that doesn't have the roof or nothing. They used to throw the bodies there.
Would you ever think about moving back here?
It's going to be an option, something that we need to look into it in the future, because if she doesn't go over there, I'm going to have to be here.
What kind of job could you get over here?
No, we work over there. I cannot
live
work
here.
Do the same as I'm doing right now.
You can work here because he's a U.S. citizen.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So whether Eusebio lives in Juarez or in El Paso, he'd still have to commute to and from every day, just like he is now, for work or to visit Maria, who can't work because she's disabled.
So we were talking the other day. You make $11 an hour
yes.
at Sam's Club.
Yes,
how
sir.
Far does that go? How much do you have left after you get your paycheck?
I get paid biweekly, and it's like around $600 because I pay my insurance. I pay everything.
Yeah, and taxes over there.
Yes, taxes and everything.
How do you guys get by then? If you make $600 every couple of weeks...
We make the best of it. That's all we have to do, just the best of it.
My aunt is the one that's helping me, taking me out.
She lives in El Paso, too, so she comes back and
forth.
So
you go over there to work, and she comes here yes. to take care of your wife.
Yes.
And you're stuck in this economy where
yes,
you
sir.
Can't sort of...
Do nothing about it. Just make the best of it.
As we said goodbye, Maria stepped out onto the sidewalk with us.
You can see our hotel, right? That's our hotel. That must make you crazy that it's that close.
Just stand up here in the door and look in towards home.
Because you can see it.
Thinking of how can I be over here.
I didn't quite get my microphone over to her quickly enough, but what she said right there was that sometimes she just stands in the door and looks toward home. It's 2 miles, tops, over the Paso del Norte and into El Paso, where Eusebio will go to work tomorrow, and where we will be as well for one more story from the borderland. You can get all the rest of our coverage from our series, My Economy. It's online at marketplace.org. You can check out our videos. And if you like, take a walk from El Paso to Juarez over the Paso del Norte with us while you're there. If you take one big step back from the nitty-gritty of all the economic data that we get about employment in this country, the latest iteration of which, by the by, is going to come tomorrow in the form of the January unemployment report. But if you do take a step back, you see the nature of the work we do in America is changing. A report out of Bentley University not too long ago makes the case that 2016 is the year of the hybrid job. Marketplace's Sally Herships explains.
It used to be graphic designers designed graphics and copywriters wrote copy. And that was that. But the times, they are a-changing.
One of my best examples of this trend is a job that was posted at the Royalton Hotel in New York for a maitre d'.
Paul Darcy is with the job site Indeed.com.
And the job description actually says that the person who they're going to hire has to be able to take ownership of the room, be fabulous, be present, be friendly, and know how to use Oracle.
Oracle, the software for managing guests and hotels. Darcy says work is changing and the culprit is software.
When new technologies require new work to be done, someone's got to do that work.
John Reed is with Robert Half, a staffing firm.
It's, it is becoming increasingly difficult to find individuals that bring this, these collection of skill sets to the table.
He says organizations are looking for hybrid jobs across the board. And if they can find candidates like Dustin Larson, they may be in luck.
I started out as a graphic designer in the print world.
Now, Larson works as a marketing manager for a 3D printing company. And at his new job, he does graphic design and copywriting and art direction.
But wait, those sound like they used to all be separate jobs.
Yes. Yeah, they used to all be separate jobs, but they were looking for a person who could just do it all.
Larson says, sure, he gets paid more, but he also has to do more work. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
What if someone's sitting at our bar and sees it and they're like, oh, let me just do shots of that. And it's like, oh, that's not really what we do here.
It's not? Really? Jägermeister? Anyone? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 79 points today, 0.5%, closed at 16,416. The NASDAQ gained 5 points, 0.1%, 4509. The S&P 500 up 2 points, 0.1%, ended things at 1,915. Retailers took a tumble today. Upscale clothier Ralph Lauren shed 22% after posting worse-than-expected third-quarter results. Department store Kohl's tumbled 18.8%. No, that's not a typo. 18.8%. Media company Viacom edged up 1.5%. That after 92-year-old majority shareholder Sumner Redstone stepped down as executive chairman. Same deal yesterday at CBS, which Redstone also owned. CBS shares today up 0.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down 1.84%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Carnival starts in Brazil this coming weekend. Street celebrations for which that country is justly famous. This year, though, the tone down there is a good deal more muted. The Brazilian economy is in the tank, and worries about the Zika virus have hit the tourism sector, and that is making things even worse. From Rio and from the BBC, Julia Carneiro has this report.
It's a hot, sunny morning here in Rio, and hundreds of tourists are streaming out of the massive Queen Mary II. The ocean liner has just arrived here in the port and is carrying over 3,000 passengers. But when this cruise started early January in England, there wasn't that much news about the spread of the Zika virus. So how do people feel about arriving in Brazil?
We're taking all precautions possible with mosquito spray and that. Actually, the ship ran out of mosquito repellent, so we had to try and find some when we went ashore.
I don't think that we were terribly concerned. I think mainly because it's affecting pregnant women, and I'm not pregnant. But it did sort of give us pause because we are considering having another child.
With several countries advising pregnant women to postpone travel to areas with Zika, many airlines are offering to refund flights for those who no longer want to come to places like Brazil. Carnival starts on Saturday in Rio, and the mayor of Rio, Eduardo Paes, has come to visit the warehouses where the city's samba schools put together their famous parades. This will be the first test of whether the fear of the Zika virus will affect tourism here. And I asked the mayor what the impact may be on the games.
I don't think it's something that we have to worry for the Olympics. It's a period of the year where this mosquito that spread this disease, it's not around. It happens on summertime. I mean, and if you take care of yourself, coming on Carnival, it's not going to be a problem. Right?
If there's one sector that hasn't suffered from the economic crisis here in Brazil, that's the production of mosquito repellent. There has been a rush to drugstores to buy repellent. And here in this shop in downtown Rio, pharmacist Maxwell da Silva tells me pregnant women are putting their names on waiting lists for the product.
Demand is huge, and unfortunately, the industry is not managing to cope.
Everyone's after a specific brand that's supposed to last longer. And when it arrives, it sells out in a few hours. It's crazy.
Tatiana Barreto is here with her niece. She says she's spending around $50 every month on repellent to protect her family from the Zika virus.
I've been coming here every week to buy repellent for my baby daughter and my sister who's pregnant. Everyone back home is really worried, and this is costing me a lot of money.
At a time of economic recession, this public health crisis is another unexpected hit for Brazil.
The BBC's Julia Carneiro in Rio for us. We talk a fair amount about brands and branding on this program because a good, strong product identity can make all the difference. But once a brand is built, it requires constant care and feeding. And even then, sometimes things go off the rails. Marketplace's Mark Garrison hit the bars and pubs of the Eastern Seaboard to bring us this story.
The Up and Up is a New York bar that makes complicated and expensive cocktails. It's the type of place where people talk about their drinks like this.
In the nose, we got dense herbal aromas. Definitely predominantly is anise. We got some orange in the background.
That's Niels Böse, who runs a bar in Germany. He's drinking a European liqueur. And by the way, he's still talking about it.
There's some sweetness derived from sugar, more or less like the tip of your tongue.
The drink he's going on about is Jägermeister. Yes, Jägermeister, the fuel that powered the ship that carried 1,000 drunken bros. Seeing it in a high-end bar is like that feeling when you start to notice that lots of people are suddenly wearing Crocs or drinking coconut water or whatever. It's probably not an accident. Some company is investing major time and money in building that trend. And right here, you're seeing how this kind of thing starts.
It's no longer about, you know, the shot you're on.
It's hard to hear in a noisy bar, but this is where a corporate strategy is executed. Jaeger hires Böse and others to talk the drink up to a carefully selected group. They're trying to get influential bartenders and drinkers to embrace a story that's about flavor and craft, not shots and pukey frat guys. It's the latest twist in the drink's strange marketing history. With a difficult name and an intensely bitter flavor, nobody saw potential for Jägermeister in the American market, except one who knew he had something after a single sip. Everybody he ever worked with knows the story of what he said.
It tastes like money. That was classic Sidney Frank.
Amanda Blanco is marketing VP at Sidney Frank Importing Company. In the 1980s, Frank took a drink for old German men and turned it into a young party drink, into the young party drink. He hired attractive women, dressed them in skimpy Jaeger outfits, and sent them into bars to pass out shots. It worked, and the entire liquor industry copied his tactics. Ted Wright is CEO of Fizz, a word-of-mouth marketing company.
I think as far as beverage alcohol in the United States, I think it's probably one of the top five achievements in the last 50 years.
Frank died in 2006. In recent years, Jägermeister has declined in America. To understand why, we're now in a Philadelphia bar called simply Irish Pub. I'm there with Americus Reed, a Wharton marketing professor who is not a regular. We talked with bar manager Sean Stenstrom.
When I first started about 3.5 years ago, we used to sell a lot of Jägermeister. After that, the Fireball craze kicked in.
Fireball cinnamon whiskey rocketed to the lead as Jägermeister fell another 7% in 2014, according to Technomic. That's why Jäger thinks its old story of shots and parties isn't enough anymore. It's now trying to reach more discerning drinkers by playing up its complex ingredients and barrel aging. It's a tale that happens to be true, but Americus Reed is struck by how jarring and different the image is.
No marketer I'm aware of attempts to try to have two different messages to two different groups because it's just too dangerous.
So Jaeger's in risky, uncharted territory. Now, since we were on a marketing fact-finding mission, we pretty much had to do Jägermeister shots before the next stop. For Reed, it was his first in about 20 years.
Okay, cheers, sir.
Cheers.
Wow, yeah, I'm starting to feel confident.
Jägermeister's confident too, though it concedes the danger of trying to reach cocktail nerds and shot drinkers simultaneously. Some observers think it could happen, like Ted Wright. Wright found success reaching influencers when Pabst Blue Ribbon hired him a few years back. The beer went from business disaster to hipster icon in a short time.
People that are influencers in booze that they've never thought about, Jägermeister in this way before. That's going to be interesting. And then when they go to a party and they're like, yeah, make me a Negroni with Jägermeister, everybody at the table is going to go, what? That's crazy. And then they get to tell the story.
Americus Reed and I next step into the Franklin Bar, run by a real-life influencer, Sarah Justice. Jägermeister's reps have courted her hard, but she won't even let the bar carry it.
What if someone's sitting at our bar and sees it and they're like, oh, let me just do shots of that. And it's like, oh, that's not really what we do here.
That kind of strong feeling underscores Reed's point about just how hard it is to sell to two crowds at once. But Jägermeister's pushing ahead, betting it can pull off the kind of surprise win that made it famous. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, the rest of the story of Martin Shkreli's testimony on Capitol Hill today. What you couldn't see on the radio in that clip of him taking the fifth that I played was the wise guy smirk on his face the whole time. Lawmakers were clearly not amused. Also this, just after he left the hearing, Shkreli tweeted out, and this is a quote, "Hard to accept that these imbeciles represent the people in our government," end of quote. That's all I got. All right, got to go. The Dow up 79 points today, about a half percent. The Nasdaq gained 5 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500, 2 points higher, a tenth of 1% there as well. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Oh, and this is APM, too, yeah.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.